This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, you're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture with me, Lim Su An. The recent news of the death of a health officer attached to Penang General Hospital has renewed allegations of bullying within the healthcare fraternity, leading to calls by doctors, medical organisations and politicians for the Ministry of Health to ensure that junior doctors aren't working in a toxic environment. Since then, Minister of Health Khairi Jamaluddin has announced that the ministry is setting up an independent task force to look into such allegations of a prevalent bullying culture in the ministry. But for those who have been bullied, especially at work, wherever your workplace might be, what toll does that take on your mental health? And what does it tell us when people working in medicine, who are meant to save lives and act with compassion, are being accused of bullying their peers? So joining me to discuss today's topic of the psychology of bullying is Dr. Joel Low, consultant clinical psychologist. Thank you so much for joining me today, Dr. Joel.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the basics, right? What's the psychology behind bullying? You know, why do people who bully choose to do so?
I think that's a really good question, good starting question, but it's quite a loaded question as well, because I think it's quite hard to answer that in a straightforward manner. Mm-hmm. I think in the simplest form, when someone bullies, it's really an exertion of power to show that I can do this to XYZ, do XYZ to ABC persons and things like that, right? And it's just to show that they have dominance over someone else or something else in that sense. Now, as to why people do it, I think there's many precursors to that. You know, one adage is that bullies are oftentimes bullies themselves. So that means they have been victims of bullies themselves. Other people feel that that's the only way that they can show that they're not weak, for example. That's the only way they can defend themselves. So there's a myriad of different reasons why someone would be a bully, like, in that sense.
When we talk of bullying, right, I think a lot of us often think of it as something that happens to kids and teens, you know, especially in schools. But It's also something that happens to adults, especially when we, you know, open up conversations about toxic workplaces, but we find that it's often not talked about as much, or a lot of people are not willing to talk about it. How different are those situations if we compare, right, bullying among kids versus bullying among adults?
Right. I think in many ways it's actually quite the same. I think the only difference is that the participants or the characters in that relationship is different, because with obviously with schools and things like that, it's children, adolescents and things like that, right? And bullying is a lot more well-known, I suppose, and also in a weird kind of way accepted, or at least anticipated. Like, people think that it's going to happen and they know it's going to happen, right? I think what happens is that as we get older, this notion of bullying, the expectation is that it goes away. You know, it's something that should remain in schools and doesn't go any further than that. Like. And I think because of that, when we go to the workplace and bullying occurs, what sometimes happens is that it's almost embarrassing to in a certain kind of way. Because, hey, I'm 25, I'm 30 years old, I shouldn't be getting bullied. That's something that only a 15-year-old or 17-year-old should be getting, right, for example. Mm. And because of that, I think people tend to not want to talk about it. Because if I'm the victim of bullying, for example, then it's like, dude, you're an adult, can't you take care of yourself, for example? That's one of the stigmas that we have. And vice versa as well. For the bullies themselves, they're wondering like, hey, you're like 30, why are you bullying people, right? What's going on there? So I think that's the only difference. In terms of what actually happens, it's quite the same.
So the sense of shame is almost magnified, right, when you're older.
That's right. Because it's not supposed to happen, quote unquote. Right?
Mm. How would you differentiate bullying from abuse then?
I think in many ways it's very overlappy in that sense, right? Mm-hmm. Because I think it's one subset of abuse, like when you get bullied by someone, right? Because when we look at abuse, generally speaking, what is that? It's about being able to control someone, being able to dictate what this person does or doesn't do, for example. And in a lot of ways, bullying is the same thing as well. I think one way to discern between the two is potentially the magnitude. I think with abuse, a lot of times it's quite all-encompassing, right? It's nonstop. There's no end to it. But for bullying, in most cases, or at least traditionally speaking, when you're talking about school settings, for example, or in the workplace, once the person leaves that situation or the environment, then it kind of stops for a little while until they go back and then it comes again. So I think that's one good way to distinguish between the two. But in many ways, I think it's quite the same.
I guess I want to say it's surprising, but it's also unsurprising that bullying exists in almost any field of work, right? Whatever field you look at, why is it something that's so pervasive? You know, is it if we look at what's happening, I guess, in Malaysia, for example, do you think that some this cultural, there's underlying cultural reasons for it? Or you know, is that something that's globally a challenge and it's just difficult to tackle regardless of which country you're looking at, which society you're looking at?
Yeah, that's a really good question, actually. It's not something that I really thought about before. I think, you know, if you think about it anecdotally, or at least from a cultural perspective, you'd think that bullying might be more pervasive in Malaysia just because of the really high or very thick power differentials, big difference of power differentials, right? I mean, and what I mean by that is that, you know, people do look up to people in authority with more deference and things like that. And naturally, I think that would make that situation prime for bullying to happen, right? From a superior, for example, and things like that. And again, culturally, you know, if Malaysia is that way inclined, it would kind of intuitively make sense that it's more prevalent here in Malaysia. But if you look across the board, you look across the literature, you know, bullying happens regardless, right? You know, Western countries, different cultures from ours, for example. And it's not like there is one culture that's immune to it or it doesn't happen. It happens across the board. So I think that's a really good question. And I think that's something that I think people will need to find out more information about before we can answer that with any certainty.
What perpetuates behavior of bullies? You know, that in some cases, like you mentioned, Dr. Joel, those who are bullies are often also previously bullied themselves.
Right, right. I think one thing that definitely doesn't stop it, like, I suppose, like, is the fact that there's oftentimes very little repercussions, right? I think a lot of times, especially from Malaysian context, the whole idea of sweeping under the rug, or, you know, let's just not make a big deal out of it, that's the pervasive idea behind notions of bullying, like, in that sense. Maybe because of embarrassment, maybe because it's too much of a hassle to deal with it, for example, and things like that. And I think when it's left unattended that way, and I think that's what's going to happen, is that people are going to say, hey, my bullying, there's no significant repercussions. I get what I want. I get to do what I want to do. So why not keep doing it? And I think that really encourages that behavior, right? And from the victim side of view as well, I think a lot of times victims, again, because of the stigma and the embarrassment factors and things like that, not many people are willing to stand up. And again, throughout history, if you look at the reports of people standing up and saying, hey, I've been a victim of bullying, I need some help and support, do they get the support? Not always, right? And I think because of that, people say, hey, let's not bother, let's just keep quiet, keep my head down, and hopefully this goes away. I think these things put together means that it's an environment that's ripe to encourage this to happen, I would think.
And in the workplace, there would also be the consideration of your own rice bowl as well, right?
That's right. Especially if you're the bullier is someone who is your superior, like a boss or a team lead or whatever it is, right? You know, the incentive to report this person is significantly reduced, because if they take their side, for example, or her side, that would mean that I'm at risk of losing my job and things like that. Exactly like what you said. That's absolutely right.
Now, another line of thought that sometimes is quite common, you know, that we hear from people around us, is that if I went through it, you should too. Does that contribute to this sort of bullying behavior?
Yeah, I think so. I think a lot of people do have this warped sense of teaching or sharing of experiences in that sense. And exactly like what you said, right? Because I went through it and it's molded me to be this person that I am, you're going to benefit from it as well, right? And I think it's what they call the abusive cycle. They don't realize the repercussions or the impact of this happening to you, right? Or to you, right? And because of that, I just pass it on, right? Without any thought or regard of what actually happens to the victim in that sense. And I think this also happens, especially in a situation like Malaysia, where the power differential is so high. Then again, it's like, I know better than you. I know best, right? So listen to me and do what I say, and then you'll be okay in the end. And it's that false promise, I think, that sometimes people say, okay, I'll just grit and bear with it, and hopefully things will turn out better, right?
That's the term, isn't it? Grin and bear it. It's saying to people, you know, just put up with it, rather than addressing the actual problem. Let's go for a quick break now, Dr. Joel, and continue our discussion when we come back. I'm speaking today to consultant clinical psychologist Dr. Joel Low, and we're talking about the psychology of bullying and its mental health impact, which we'll get to after the break. So keep it here on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture with me, Lim Soo Ann. Joining me on the show today is consultant clinical psychologist Dr. Joel Low, and we're talking about the mental health impact of bullying, particularly among adults in the workplace. Now, this is coming off recent and renewed allegations of a toxic culture of bullying among the medical fraternity, but we're also looking more broadly at the problem of bullying among adults, you know, of bullying as not just something that happens to kids, to teenagers in school, but often happen in the workplace as well, but we don't talk enough about it. And that's really like I spoke about earlier with Dr. Joel, you know, sometimes often due to a sense of shame that it shouldn't be happening to you if you're an adult. But Dr. Joel, how does bullying affect someone's mental and emotional well-being? And I imagine that there would be repercussions in the short and long run as well.
That's right. I think let's look at it from a short-term perspective. I think when you're the victim of bullying, that means your ability to be who you are, who you want to be, is significantly diminished, right? Now, from someone who has a lot of agency to advocate for myself, to do what I want to do, for example, it's all taken away from me. And now I have to be this version or this idea that someone else wants for me, whether it be someone who's submissive or what have you, in that sense, right? And in the short term, that's very difficult because of the incongruencies, right? I want to be X, I'm being forced to be Y. Because of that gap between those two, it makes me want. And when I want for things and I don't have it and I don't have any ability to change that situation, that makes someone depressed, anxious, stressed out, and all that kind of stuff. In the long term, I think if this doesn't go away, that also means that this person gets into this stage of a learned helplessness, where they start thinking that, hey, you know, I can't take care of myself. This is my lot in life. I can't do anything more than that. Why bother trying, dreaming, hoping, you know, for better things when it's not going to happen, right? And because of that, this person becomes a shell of a human being that they were before, right? So I think that's the major psychological part about it, right? That really affects a lot of people when I'm not allowed to be who I want to be, and that's difficult.
Now, I should have asked this earlier, Dr. Joe, but what forms can bullying take, especially when we look at, among adults or in the workplace? Because when we think of, you know, bullying among kids, or it's the older kid, you know, just threatening the younger one, maybe push, you know, physically bullying them or asking for pocket money or things like that, right? But if we look at a situation among adults or in a workplace, right, what can bullying look like?
There are some instances where actually what you described is also what happens with adults as well, right? So they are being forced, maybe not so much in financial or monetary terms, but things like threatening someone to take a bad shift that I don't want to take, for example, or not taking a leave on a certain day so that I can take leave, for example, and things like that. And I think those are the more well-known or traditional forms of bullying that we are familiar with, because it's so explicit, it's so obvious and so clear-cut, in that sense, right? And from an outside perspective looking in, that's also the most obvious ones that we see and we can try and do something about. Now, I think the more dangerous one, just because it's so subtle, is the emotional, psychological kind of bullying and abuse, right? Those are the ones where they say, you know, if you look at it from a school perspective, it's like, hey, if you don't do what we do, don't like what we like, I'm not going to friend you. I'm not going to isolate you. I'm going to alienate you, for example, right? Mm-hmm. And you extrapolate that to workplace settings. These are the situations where you would isolate or alienate one colleague. You might gaslight them, for example, and say, hey, no, we all think this way. You think a different way, for example. And these, for me, from my perspective, these are the more dangerous ones because it's so invisible. You don't see it happening, right? At least it's not clearly obvious. But the ramifications are severe, if not more severe than the more physical versions of bullying, right? The last one, I think, is really about abuse of power. When we are able to throw our rank and privileges around in that sense to get what we want to have.
With invisible forms of bullying, would the person who is doing the bullying or the person who is on the receiving end even realize it at some points?
I think for the bullier, the perpetrator, I think more often than not, there is some sense of realization, right? Mm-hmm. Whether or not they connect the dots between what they're doing is bullying, that's questionable, we don't know. So sometimes, like we said earlier on, because I got this in the past, so I'm replicating it. So I don't know, I don't connect the dots. I don't think of it as bullying, right? But they will know that they're doing something, right? I think that much is certain. For the victims, I think it really depends on how subtle the exertion of power is. For some people, they don't. And you know, if you look at the other end of the extreme, abusive people, right? People who are abusers, more often than not, this abuse happens very slowly. It's a very slow burn kind of thing, right? And the reason why they do that is because if it's a sudden and abrupt kind of exertion of power, people are more likely to resist, right? As opposed to someone who goes through it or does it in a very subtle, slow burn kind of manner. It's like that frog in a pot analogy. You know how if you put a pot in, frog in the hot, boiling hot water, it jumps out. But if you put it in cool water and slowly bring the water up to boil, the frog doesn't know it's getting boiled alive, like, basically. I think that same thing applies here as well, right? So a lot of times, if the bullies are quite subtle, the victims are not going to know it until it's later on, basically.
Now, we're talking about bullying among adults because of the unfortunate recent allegations, actually renewed allegations as well, of bullying among healthcare workers. There was that recent case of a doctor who died, which they're still investigating. You know, we don't know if it was due to bullying or it's simply reports and allegations at the moment. But there have been reports in the past, which you know, studies and surveys which found that bullying does happen among healthcare workers. How harmful is it for bullying to happen in a profession such as medicine, and for it to happen between doctors, people who are supposed to heal others, to have empathy and compassion, right? How harmful is it for it to happen in a situation like that? And what message does it tell the public?
How harmful is it? I think it's incredibly harmful. To be fair, I mean, even if you replace the medication, medical profession with any other profession for that matter, the harms are incredible, right? I think there's no way of diluting that impact, right? But I think with something like with medicine, with the medical profession, with doctors, I think it's amplified because the propensity for them to then replicate that or translate that to other people, especially in their position of power and control and care, is going to be there, right? So best case scenario, what? They transfer it to younger doctors, junior doctors. Worst case scenario is to their patients, right? You know, you do, and again, you do hear stories in the medical field where there are some doctors who do abuse their power for whatever reasons, like whether it's sexual abuse or financial abuse or whatever it is, right? And you do see that happening. And because it's something that was passed on over the years, so to speak, right, from seniors and things like that, it almost normalizes it. And I think that just makes it, like I said earlier on, right, sometimes they may not even realize that it's abuse or bullying, right? They may just think that, hey, it's just something that's done. It's just what it is, you know. So in terms of the impact, I think it's significant. And I think being in the profession that they are, where so many lives and things are at stake, it really amplifies it even more, like, in that sense. Like,
you know, we often hear that their work conditions are far more stressful than perhaps your average person, right? That, you know, they work long hours, they're often shorthanded. I guess how much does work conditions actually contribute to people behaving badly, people behaving like bullies? Is that is there a valid reason behind that statement?
I think this is quite valid, and from both sides of the divide as well. From the bullies' perspective, you know, it's one of those things where it can be misconstrued as, hey, I'm not bullying these younger doctors. I'm trying to toughen them up because the job is inherently a hard one, a difficult one, and they've got a long journey ahead of them. And by me acting the way that I am, the false belief is that I'm going to make them stronger doctors, better doctors, more resilient doctors, right? So I think that's one part that's happening. From the victim's point of view, you know, I think given in the situation that you rightly described, as so stressful, there's so high intensity, and there's so much at stake, I think it makes that person more susceptible to abuse because all my cognitive faculties, all my attention is focused on trying to do a job. And when I get feedback from my superiors, for example, or other senior doctors or more senior members or whatever it is, right, that means that I'm more susceptible to what they say to me, right? That means all the criticisms and things like that. And especially coming from an air where I've been there, done that, listen to me, trust me, I can help you out, right? And, you know, you're learning on the job, you're trying to do a good job and trying to impress, then naturally you're more inclined to fall into that victim pattern in that sense, right? And I'm not saying that it's right or wrong, but it is what's happening, unfortunately, you know.
You know, earlier I asked you about the mental health impact of being bullied, but what happens when you push someone to the point where, you know, they simply can't take it anymore, right? And in this recent report, it's alleged that the doctor had died by suicide. But would something like that be a possibility if someone was bullied for a prolonged time?
Yeah, yeah. And research and case studies have told us or showed us that this is one possible outcome, right? I think, like I said earlier on, with the one of the biggest impact that abuse or bullying can occur to a victim is the loss of agency, the loss of the ability to be who they want to be, right? And when there is no way out for them, or at least they perceive that there's no way out for them, that means they're stuck in this, whatever it is that they're stuck in for, however long it's going to be, that sense of helplessness can be very, very debilitating, right? And, you know, sometimes people quit. You know, in this case, I mean, if the allegations are true, the best case scenario is they quit, they leave the system, they stop being doctors and they do whatever else they want to do in the future, right? And that's the best case scenario, which is really sad if you think about it, because mm-hmm. medical degree is what, 6 years, 7 years or something like that? And then mm-hmm. all this training as well, it's a shame, it's a waste.
Mm-hmm.
Worst case scenario, when they feel they get to a point where they're so helpless and hopeless, where they feel that they have no way out, suicide can sometimes be an unfortunately, I wouldn't say better option, but it seems like the only option, right? Because they have nowhere else to go, maybe because of parental pressures. They say, no, don't leave, stay there. It's a good job, it's a good future. And you're stuck, right? And sometimes when you're stuck for so long, for so hard, I think sometimes that can be the only option that they consider, which is really, really unfortunate, right? And I think because of that, I think a lot of people, a lot more knowledge and awareness and education and conversations need to be had about this to make sure that these people know that there are other options, there are other things that they can explore and consider.
But when bullying can be so individual, right? Mm. When it can be so hard for people to speak up about, I guess, where do you even start? You know, is something like this better tackled from a top-down perspective or a bottom-up perspective?
I think with something like, it depends on the setting, I suppose. If you're looking at it from a school perspective, then potentially mm-hmm. a bottom-up perspective might be better because you want to get in touch with the people who could be bullies and also the victims of bullying as well and help support them and give them advocacy and teach them about assertiveness and all that kind of things, right? But if you look at it from an institutional perspective, like the medical faculty, for example, or let's say law, whatever it is, whatever mm-hmm. things that you can do, then I think a top-down perspective is going to be not much more effective, right? And the reason why I say that is because, like what we mentioned earlier, if it's something that's been like, you know, turun temurun kind of thing, like it's been mm-hmm. past ages and ages and ages really, it's become institutionalized. It's almost like a rite of passage. You need to be bullied so that you'll be better, stronger, more resilient and all that, which is crazy if you think about it. And you're not going to change that from the bottom up. No way, right? It has to start from the very top. Someone needs to make a decision that says, hey, no, it's a zero policy kind of thing. We're not going to condone it. This has to stop. This has to change. And only then that I think that the changes can trickle down towards the everyday person, I would think.
To be a bit more pessimistic, you know, can bullies ever change?
Yeah, of course. You know, I think look at it from one perspective would be the bullies who are inadvertently bullying, right? That means they know they're engaging the behavior, but they don't connect the knots that they are bullying. And the sudden realization that, oh my goodness, I actually am bullying someone, I'm actually causing harm and hurt to this person, can be catalyst enough for them to say, right, I'm off. I'm not going to do this anymore, right? I know better now and I'm going to stop, right? For the people who know that they're bullying and they're actively bullying, I think a lot of times from a psychological perspective or therapy perspective anyways, the awareness and realization that it comes from a place of hurt, right? Very rarely do people hurt other people for fun, for no reason. I mean, of course, if you look at the social parts of the world, then yes, that's a separate category. But the everyday person, we don't do it for no reason, right? We do it because of our own hurt, our own past transgressions, for example, retaliation against other people or perceived other people's, for example, and things like that, right? Whether it's fair or not, we don't know. But when it comes from a place of hurt like that, I think when they can instead realize that, hey, I've been a victim of bullying, I've gone through a lot of bad things in my life, and I'm taking out on people now, that gives them the capacity to say, I can get better, I can do better, right? So I don't think there's such a situation where bullies can never change, right? Sometimes it might be harder than usual, right? Like, you know, let's say people have been doing it for many, many years, for example, but it's never impossible. I always think that there is some measure of help that we can give to them.
And to wrap up, Dr. Joel, you know, from the perspective of the person on the receiving end, right? Sometimes it's understandably can be very hard to stand up against your bully, you know, because you found yourself in that situation. But what can someone do, especially if it's something that's happening in your workplace?
From a general perspective, I think advocating for yourself, being assertive, would always be my first protocol, right? Because if you don't have that done, that means that that bullying will continue perpetually, right? And there's not something that we can change if we don't change the equation in that sense. So standing up for yourself, advocating for yourself, making the right decisions for yourself and taking care of yourself, I think that should always be the first step. Now, is that always going to be effective? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe there's some extenuating circumstances that you mentioned earlier on, like I got to take care of my rice bowl, I can't afford to lose the job and things like that. Then the next step would be to try and gain some allies, right? So getting people that who have gone through similar experiences, for example, asking them how they cope. Maybe you guys can band together and speak to this person or HR, for example, and things like that. And hopefully through sheer strength of voice, we can enact more change in that sense, right? I think the third thing, if all that fails, then I think the onus is on ourselves to then make good choices for ourselves within our own sphere of influence, which is our own selves, right? Mm-hmm. So meaning, if you are able to, let's say you're on rotation, you're only with this supervisor for a month, 2 months, or whatever it is, can you grit and bear with it? Can you just hang on until you're done so that you can leave that place and then you're in a better place after that? That's my least recommended option because it's not fair, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it puts so much cognitive demand on this victim that I don't think it's fair because then they'll do badly at the jobs and all the kind of things as well, right? But I think broadly speaking, this would probably be the three things that I would encourage someone to do if they are the victims themselves.
Ultimately, think of what's best for yourself, right? And how you can achieve that, I guess, regardless of in whichever way that's most comfortable with you, confrontational or non-confrontational.
That's right. That's right. And making sure that your safety, your well-being is priority at all times.
All right. And on that note, thank you so much, Dr. Joel.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
I've been speaking to consultant clinical psychologist Dr. Joel Low on the psychology behind bullying and why we need to talk about bullying as something that does happen among adults, as something that does happen in the workplace, and how we can address it. And it really depends on what the situation is like where you are. If you missed any part of today's show or any previous Live and Learn episodes, you can download the podcast on bfm.my or on the BFM app. I'm Lim Suan, and this has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.